The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
To understand the predicament of anxiety, we need only sit down quietly, draw our attention inward, and watch our thoughts as they tumble by. Our fears and concerns need not assume vast proportions, but beneath the melody of constantly changing thoughts, punctuating them like the thumping of the bass in a jazz quintet, is the persistent throb of worry and care, the second rhythm of the heart. I've read that and found that provocative and evocative description of life, the thumping of the bass in the jazz quintet of anxiety. So I thought I would reflect on this together. Freud, maybe in some ways similar to Bhikkhu Bodhi, it once defined anxiety in such a fundamental way that he said that anxiety is basically what gets us to do anything. You know, this fundamental motivating force. And when we look in the suttas in the Buddhist tradition, this word dukkha, or the translated alternatively as suffering, or sometimes actually Tanissaro Bhikkhu as stress. That's his translation of dukkha, stress, close to anxiety. That word etymologically, what I've learned from scholars is that it's like the axle not fitting into the wheel well perfectly, so that it's not always a smooth ride. Yeah, that's the first noble truth. There is that. And when I think about my life and how I, you know, what is a kind of propelling force in my life, you know, what gets me checking my third email account again? It's something in the neighborhood of restlessness. And I think one of the defining characteristics of the mind when it's quite free of kilesa, of habits, habit energies, the afflictive energies, it's the restlessness that flatlines. That in some of the states of mind or stages of awareness, the restlessness is gone. We notice that, and it can be like the rumble of like a loud refrigerator or something that shuts off, and we didn't really know it was rumbling, and then it shuts off, and there's that like delicious peace. And when restlessness, when anxiety really fades out, there is this deep ease. Now, it's useful to distinguish some kinds of fear, maybe, from anxiety. Fear being a deeply conditioned response of the body and something that we should be grateful for. Fear is more like the alarms that go off when there's a harm that is in front of us that can be avoided. Yeah? Like that would be a useful time to feel fear. And so Ajahn Amara, who I mentioned last week, the Thai forest tradition, said, when we look back over evolutionary time, the ancestors who got to the edge of a really kind of steep, frightening cliff in prehistoric times, the ancestors that got to the edge of that cliff and felt warm, mushy, loving feelings at the edge of that cliff, just metta and just warmth, and they're not our ancestors. Right? And so here we are, these like slightly nervous monkeys, you know. And we can be grateful for a lot of those mechanisms. There are also times maybe that are more the anxiety family where, and the anxiety being a kind of much more sort of future concern, fear being a more present focus concern to anxiety being much more future oriented, very much bound up with thinking, worry, kind of vigilance and obsessive thought and hyper arousal, the body's in like it's idling at a much higher point. And there are times when I think that kind of anxiety can really can serve us. It's like some people call it like true alarm anxiety. So to give an example of this, there was when I was writing a thesis, there was a long period of procrastination about 4 years in. And this is fairly normal from what I understand from other students, but there was, and now I was not purely wasting the time. I was doing a lot of meditation, but it was like meditation so that I did not have to write this freaking thesis. And that went on for many months. And I would sit down at the computer and it would be like, maybe I could look at it one or two sentences, and then it was off to the internet or something, yeah. This kind of worked for a while, you know. Like there was a little sense of concern, but not much. And then at some point, over 6 months of doing this, there was like some anxiety. And it was the kind of anxiety that it sort of alerts us to the fact that we need to take action, you know, that we're actually, it's that anxiety is wise counsel that we're being asked to move on something. We've let some kind of pain or confusion fester for too long, and it's now time to actually be decisive and act. And you know, after all that time, that it was that kind of anxiety that was actually very supportive in cutting through that habit of procrastination. We worry, we have a kind of redemptive hope in worrying. We have an allegiance to worrying. It feels like worrying gets a lot done for us. It feels like in that worrying, we're kind of almost rearranging the world with our thoughts, with our worries. Does that make sense? So this is from The Onion. Do you know that? That's good. A lot of people laugh. That's good. It's hard for me to have a single conversation with a person without thinking about The Onion at some point. And it doesn't matter what we're talking about. I always have associations with this thing. Anyway, this was from today. I'll read the story. It's a short story. And it's the picture is this, you know, this young guy who's in bed and he's like throwing off the sheets and he's got a pad and a paper and he's writing in, you know, like at the edge of his bed. Quickly kicking off his sheets and reaching for a notepad on his nightstand, local 27-year-old Kyle Dowling reportedly sprang out of bed at 3 a.m. yesterday to jot down an idea for a brand new worry. Sometimes the best, most crippling new anxieties just come to you in the middle of the night. So it's always good to have a pen and paper nearby to record them, said Dowling, rapidly scribbling several shorthand notes about a new feeling of debilitating self-doubt and apprehension that had just spontaneously entered his mind. If I think of a new paralyzing fear relating to my personal or professional life and I don't immediately write it down, there's a good chance I'll totally forget about it by the time I fall asleep 4 hours later. Upon waking up and rereading his notes from the previous night, Dowling confirmed to reporters that the new worry was even greater than he first thought. Yeah. So that's The Onion, but it's very closely paralleled. Why is that funny? Because it very closely parallels what was written by a researcher at Penn State who's sort of like the guru of worry, of worrying research. Yeah. And he wrote a very personal piece a few years ago. He's clearly involved in mindfulness in some ways. This is Thomas Borkovec, who says, "When I'm worrying, I am mostly engaging in thought or talking to myself. This thinking, triggered by an internal or external cue that signals danger, primarily concerns the future and involves the anxious anticipation of and mental attempts to avoid the many negative events that I imagine might happen. The consequence of any perception of threat is the activation of basic fight or flight reactions, motivating attempts to escape or avoid. Quite naturally, under those circumstances, I feel compelled to figure out how to prevent these bad things from happening or how to prepare myself for the worst. Worrying is a device that I believe can function to do this. Because I'm devoting large amounts of time to generating and attending to worrisome thoughts, much of my life is spent living in an illusion." So, no doubt there's a place for some simulation that we imagine different scenarios, things that could unfold, and there's a lot of value for us in that. There's, you know, it's not an accident that we all have these brains, minds that when we sit down to focus on the breath does a lot of simulation of the future. That's not like a total evolutionary accident. Now, that may not we no doubt do too much of that, but it's not a total accident, and there's some real value in being able to simulate various futures, yeah. But it's like our allegiance to that is so strong, and we're kind of trying to avoid harms that can't be avoided or can't be controlled, or we're worrying about the wrong things, or we're worrying too much about the right things. So it's become unbalanced. And in this this process of worrying, one of the things that it's important to recognize is that we're not so good at predicting the future, and we're even less good probably at predicting how we're going to feel in the future. So there's a whole body of research around affective forecasting, predicting our own states in the future, our own emotional kind of states. And one of the very interesting findings from that is that we essentially underestimate our resilience. We underestimate our resilience. And we also let what's happening in the mind right now has undue weight in how we think about the future. Totally undue weight. What's happening right now so strongly affects how we think about the future. And so it's good to be humble about what worry can actually do for us. A lot of times worry and anxiety comes when we feel like we've reached a kind of fork in the road. And it feels like we come to these forks again and again and again in life. But when we come to that fork and it's like it could go this way or it could go that way, it doesn't feel like a fork. It feels like the fork. It feels like this is it. Like my life has come to this decision or this point. And it can either go right or it can go wrong. And so we spend a lot of time kind of obsessionally trying to figure out which is right, which is wrong. But in that obsession, in that worry, we've forgotten about all the forces that are propelling our life already. We sort of overestimate how different those, Frost said, right? There are two, came to two paths, right? And I took the one less road less traveled. And that made all the difference. But that's often not true. Did that path make all the difference? Did things unfolding this way make all the difference or that way? When I look back at my life, it's very hard to actually see true forks, When you really look back at your life, and I think about all the times or places that I was worried about, how many real forks were there? So many less than I thought, I would say. Now we can try to plan, and of course should. But a lot of times our anxiety is a little bit like an attempt to outsmart the First Noble Truth. Yeah, it's like there is difficulty, and part of what really gets the mind going is this, the imagination that there is a dukkha-free path. And if we just think hard enough and repetitively enough, we'll actually figure out that, yeah, going right, that's dukkha-free. Yeah. I do that, you know, that especially when people are thinking about they feel like they're at that fork in the road, that whether it's a job or relationship or moving or, you know, a medical decision, it feels like they're at that fork, and it feels like we're looking, the mind is really seeking that dukkha-free path. But part of what we're doing here in this practice, and part of what makes us much less anxious, is we are like fully comprehending, which means opening the heart to the First Noble Truth. And that's not a depressing kind of heavy thing to do. In fact, Carol Wilson, a teacher mostly at IMS, she said, if you're bummed out by the First Noble Truth, you're not really understanding it. So we're loosening the grip on controlling things. We to take the First Noble Truth into the heart is to know. Sometimes it's translated, the truth of impermanence is translated as not as impermanence, anicca, but as uncertainty. You know, don't know. Now, that leaves us maybe feeling kind of vulnerable, but part of our practice is cultivating a kind of courage and a sense that the heart can weather the various tides of conditions. That's part of what we're practicing on the cushion, in the chair, is we're developing a confidence that we can actually bear with all of the different conditions that arise in life. This intolerance of uncertainty runs really so deeply, and I know in my life, I can see myself as kind of compulsively seeking ground, seeking a kind of place to stand, some sort of haven, something outside of change. And in that is anxiety and a need to control and kind of braced against the tides of impermanence. But we're learning more and more to actually develop and taste a sense of safety amidst change. It's not like we open to change and it's terrifying and destabilizing, but we actually let go into groundlessness in a way that which actually creates a sense of safety and ease. Joseph Goldstein says that this is the first realization. We've sort of like jumped out of the plane with our parachute, or we think with our parachute, and the first realization is, we have no parachute. Yeah. And then the second realization is there is no ground. Yeah. And that is, I love that. That's we're falling through life, through space. I mean, that is, I sometimes almost have that visual image of just like falling through space, and like I try to hold on to this person, to this identity, to this, home or money or this, you know, it's just like, and we're just falling through space. And of course, there's some like fear in that for a lot of people, and there's some genuine relief when that complementary insight, there is no ground. So we start to develop a confidence, and the heart can weather the tides of impermanence. There's a lot of interest in the clinical world for around mindfulness for mental health generally, but anxiety specifically. Actually, a recent something was published in a very traditional, well-respected medical journal, JAMA Internal Medicine, just a couple weeks ago. They did a meta-analysis, so they sort of aggregated all the findings from mindfulness meditation-based studies, most of which I think was mindfulness-based stress reduction, so an 8-week program, and looked at its effect on anxiety and depression, and their conclusions. Clinicians should be aware that meditation programs can result in small to moderate reductions of multiple negative dimensions of psychological stress. Thus, clinicians should be prepared to talk with their patients about the role that a meditation program could have in addressing psychological stress. I have a lot of hope for, and that's in 8 weeks. You know, it's like, who's been here for more than 8 weeks? Yeah, who thinks they're done after 8 weeks? When I think about my meditation practice on day one and day 56, it was like Matthew's mind is a circus on day one. Matthew's mind is definitely still a circus at day 56, right? It's like we're just like just starting to scratch the surface. So it's remarkable to me when I see these studies actually find, you know, consistent literature emerging around 8-week kind of programs, whereas we know that is not adequate dosage, right? And so anyway, so I'm quite enthusiastic about this with mindfulness for anxiety. The basic mechanism, one of the main ways that anxiety gets treated psychotherapeutically is something, you know, like exposure therapy. That's a major component. And so just very briefly sketching this, the principle is that there's associations between a particular object or stimulus and a fear response. And the basic approach is to begin to separate the stimulus from the fear response. And so to use a very simple example, if somebody is phobic of snakes, you might do like a systematic desensitization whereby you would kind of first maybe have the person write the word in the clinical room, you'd have them write the word snake on the paper and do some anxiety reducing strategies in that moment, yeah, to the point where it felt totally like that act of writing snake felt like it was totally manageable. Totally manageable, and the fear response didn't arise. And then you would sort of move up the hierarchy to maybe looking at a picture of a snake, and then a video, and then going to a zoo, but not going in the snake exhibit. And then eventually you've got the boa constrictor wrapped around your neck, and you're at ease, you know, as you sort of successively master this, yeah? And so this is called systematic desensitization. And mindfulness, in a lot of ways, is like unsystematic desensitization. We don't have the hierarchy from riding snake to the boa constrictor, but we're being asked to make peace with everything. And if we sit enough, it all arises. It's just, that's the logic of the Dharma. It all arises for us. Everything we need to make peace with will arise if we're open, honest. And so over time, we're, you know, and of course we're sitting, right? So we're sitting in the steadiness of the body, the ease of the breath, you know, the openness of the heart, mind, and we're meeting all of the, everything that could disrupt our peace with that stability. So all of the panicky thoughts or emotions or memories, or it all gets integrated in this way. Now it's important to have, you know, in this process, as we kind of digest our anxiety, one of the important principles is for the level of distress not to be too high and not to be too low. Like in the therapeutic situation, the therapy doesn't work if you're doing things that don't cause any anxiety. So if you just kept writing snake on the paper, that's not going to do it. But if you come in on day two, the boa's around the neck and it's a full-on meltdown, that's counterproductive too. And in our practice, maybe there's a parallel. We certainly don't want more than we can handle. We don't want more than we can handle. We want to be able to maintain some level of mindfulness with what's coming up, with that anxious experience. And so we have to use our judgment, like when do we just stay with it? When do we move to, you know, some other relaxed place in the body? When do we get up and take a walk? We have to use our judgment with that. We work on the deconstructing the actual experience of anxiety. And this is something that that Shinzen Young, who's on teaching Saturday, will probably talk a fair amount about. But actually picking apart the different phenomena involved in anxiety or any experience. When it gets all tangled up, when the thinking, and the thinking being talk and images, gets tangled up with feeling in the body, and there's a kind of pinball effect between the anxious thought, the discomfort in the body, the images of the future, the dire ones, or the dukkha-free ones, or whatever, you know, when the attention starts to really pinball there between image, talk, and feeling, this is can become overwhelming. When we can start to untangle the actual experience so that we're actually infusing mindfulness into those different components of experience, this dramatically decreases the kind of overwhelm. So a couple more things before we stop. Part of what a major source of anxiety, in my experience, is the kind of fear of being found out. You know, like we can be. Like we feel a lot of the time like our cover can be broken, you know, or like somebody can find out more than we want them to know, or And part of our practice is actually creating an integrated life where we feel like there's nothing to hide, where we feel like we've made peace with all of our secret material, and we feel like we can bring an authenticity to our interactions, so that literally we can't be found out, because we're not hiding anything anymore. We're not hiding from ourselves. We're not hiding from others. And so there's this piece around authenticity and making peace with our past and with all the different parts of ourselves, and gathering that into a sense of wholeness that we're not ashamed of. You know? And we may regret things. We may have really sensitive, tender zones in our life. We may be very private about certain things. But there's not that sense of I could be found out. And, part of why I don't feel anxious teaching is because I know that I'm being really honest about my experience, and I do care about this. And this is my life. And so I may be wrong. No doubt I'm wrong about lots of stuff. But I've got nothing to hide. Yeah. And this kind of leads to a sense of ease. So lastly, We become confident in the kind of trajectory of the heart, that the way we care for the future is to take good care of the heart now. And when we really look at like what are the seeds of our well-being, where will happiness come from in the future, the best we can do is nourish the heart now, to take good care of that. And we develop a kind of trust in that. And that's not an anxious process. We just do what we can to nourish the heart. And that has effects. But that's how we care for our lives, and that's how we do what we can to insulate ourselves from the ups and downs of life, is to care well for the heart. And to care well is to learn letting go. So the Buddha said, not apart from relinquishing all do I see any safety for living beings. Not apart from relinquishing all do I see any safety for living beings. Let's just sit for a moment. May whatever goodness is here tonight together, may this be of benefit for all that we encounter. May whatever joy and freedom and ease is ours, may this be of service in small or big ways. Be a cause for the reduction of suffering, increase in peace and kindness. Thank you. Nice to be with you. Have a good night.